Okay. So, here we are in our penultimate weekend of this first phase. So, our final weekend will be in about a month for online. And what we're particularly going to be focusing on this weekend is the path between Ahod and Netzach, which has the Tower card, the Tower attached to it. And the path we will look at in our final weekend is the path between Tiferet and Yesod. Now, part of what I want to do in this weekend is to reprise and look at what the paths we have done. Because the particular quality of the path that we're now looking at is the dissolution and the reconstruction of the House of Life. The tower image is of the tower that falls down. Just the and it relates in a way to the story of Merlin. It relates to the story of Merlin you find in Geoffrey of Monmouth's History of the Kings of Britain, where Vortigern, who is the false king, who is the king whose sovereignty is in his own interests, not in the interest of the people and the land, is trying to build a tower where he can be safe, where nobody can get at him. And the tower is it's an actual place in North Wales called Dinas Emrys. And the tower keeps falling down. And so he goes to his soothsayers and his seers and who are in the service of the false king, the service of a sovereignty that is not about true sovereignty, not about serving life, but is about, you know, serving Vortigern's own selfish and particular needs, irrespective of the damage he causes. They say, well, what you need, the thing that will work, is if we find a boy who has not had a father, and what we need to do is to sacrifice him and mix his blood with the mortar, and then the tower will hold. Now, this in effect is it's a motif you find often in a lot of different traditions: the sacrifice of the innocents, the sacrifice of innocence, to serve the normally a corrupt old person who wants to hang on to things. And it's not hard in the world to see that actually at work. You know, if all you have to do is to think of young Russian soldiers at the moment serving an old man who wants to be remembered like Peter the Great. You know, and so this image of the sacrifice of innocence and innocence is a very, very ancient human thing. We find it in all traditions. It's that place where, as you want get older, you want to hang on. You don't want to move on, and you're willing to sacrifice the young in order for that to happen. A much more trivial and banal thing is the thing that you often see men and young, particularly men. It's not just men; women also do it to some extent, but much more men. Pack in their family and get a new wife and a new family when they're really quite old. It's the same kind of idea of instead of moving on, instead of embracing the energies of death and resurrection, of trying to hang on to something that has genuinely passed. And in a sense, what happens in the Merlin story, you know, it's based around Carmarthen. You probably know this already, but the Welsh word for Carmarthen is Caer Myrddin, which is the place of Myrddin, the castle, the enclosure of Merlin. And I'm not sure anymore if Merlin's oak is still standing there, but if you are, but it's not, it's gone. Oh, shame. There used to be an oak tree there. There was said to be Merlin's oak, but it's quite a nice place, but it has these very numinous kind of roots, really. But and Merlin in the story is the child of a nun and a daemon of the upper air. Merlin is a Christ figure. I mean, Christ equally. We were used to thinking this, but Christ is also has no mortal father, and so he is this numinous kind of figure. And Merlin, sometimes in later Christian tradition, is called the child of the devil. But actually, he's a child who is both here and not here. Who is both. Born of a human mother, but born of the spirit. And in a certain deeper sense, we could say that all this is true of all human beings. We are born of the spirit, we are born of a human mother. But anyway, he is this kind of magical kind of child, and so he's brought to this falling down tower. And you know, they're all about to sacrifice him, but he calls this magical child, he challenges the Vortigern and his magicians, and he says, well, no, they're just getting it completely wrong. I will show you what the issue. I'll show you why the tower keeps falling down. And in a sense, he descends, he goes deep into the hill of Dinas Emrys, and he gets people to dig out the hill. Because underneath the surface of Dinas Emrys, where the land is continually shifting, there is a great pool. And it's the great, and this in a sense is the pool of, this is the pool of the salmon well, with the wellspring that we were looking at in our meditation. And in a sense, gets the pool drained, so he goes underneath the pool. And what we find underneath the pool are two great stone eggs that are sort of bashing against each other. They're creating vibration that keeps the foundations unsteady. And then he looks into the nature of these two eggs or two barrels, and as those barrels are open, what appears is two great dragons, a white dragon and a red dragon, who start to fight and to spin around each other, spiral around each other. And here he's tapping into the deep energies of life, the yin and the yang, the left and the right, the no and the yes. And he then goes into this tremendous prophecy where he prophesies the whole creation and apocalypse, and it's the extraordinary kind of image, really, because actually what he's doing at that point, he's tapping into the deep energies of life. He's going into the salmon pool, into the story of the salmon, into the roots of the beginning, into the being that is the oldest of all, and embracing the two energies, the red and the white. And in that moment, he becomes free of time and he sees the great story of the universe. Even to the great end, where we have the great goddess figure Ariadne in this story, who brings the winds of the world together back into her womb with a great clap, as everything is. So we have this sense of everything expanding, growing, fighting, falling apart, re-establishing itself, and then it all returns back into the womb of the mother Ariadne, who is the Norman French equivalent of Ariannrod, who is the great Welsh goddess of destiny. And in the Tree of Life, we would see her as Bina, the mother of all. Now, what happens in that moment is that Merlin embraces true sovereignty and knights his own life, his own world, with the great energies of the universe, with the deep energies of the destiny of the land and the destiny of the universe. And that place becomes untouchable. And it's one of the particular prophecies which does not delight Vortigern, is that Ambrosius and Uther Pendragon are coming over the sea from Little Britain to Britain to drive out the Saxons and dispossess Vortigern. And subsequently, what Vortigern does, he and his daughter wall themselves up in another castle and end up being burned to death. And again, there's a lot of interesting stuff in the history. What do you see Vortigern doing, having failed here, then creates another tower, and the implication of being walled up with his daughter is he's trying to do something sexual with his daughter to enable his reign to continue, to enable his life energy to sustain itself. And in the end, that tower falls completely. So one of the issues that this path confronts us with is the preparation path before entering into the experience of Tiferet, which is the experience of true sovereignty. Tiferet is that middle sphere of the tree, the great mediating sphere that links all the other spheres together. And in a way, it's that place where it's that voice of the intuition that speaks underneath our patterns. Underneath our thoughts, our feelings, our memories, it is that sense that aligns us and connects us with everything else. But that energy, if seized on by the lower spheres of the tree, and in particular where the sense of self that is created in Yesod, can be misused most powerfully and most dreadfully. Because the capacity of Tiferet is the capacity to connect and to understand. Now, if connecting and understanding is used in the service of life, it is a great power for healing. If it's used in the service of manipulation, that knowledge, that capacity, that intuitive way of relating to people can be a most poisonous and terrible thing. Now, one of the things that we find in Brythonic tradition in particular, not just Brythonic, it also embraces the Irish traditions, is the whole idea of sovereignty is very important. Being king, being queen. There's something special about it. Ali and I are watching the series Vikings at the moment on Amazon Prime. And it's a wonder, I love it. It's not profound, and it's very bloody, and so you've got to be able to handle quite a lot of gore if you watch Vikings. One of the interesting things in it is that there are a number of kings in it. And it's not the kings of little places. They're not kind of, great dominating imperial kind of figures. One of them is King Harald Fairhair, who wants to become the King of Norway. In fact, does become the King of Norway in actual history. But there's a point where Lagertha, who's a queen of somewhere called Kattegat, has him locked up, and he's lost all his men, and he tried to undermine her, and he got found out, and he's locked up, and so they're having a conversation. And his solution to the situation he's in is to offer her his hand in marriage. And she said, well, why would I want to marry you? You haven't got any warriors, I've got you, I've defeated you. But I am a king, he said. And there's various points where this is, I am a king, this kind of spoken, and I'm a queen, is the same thing if you're a woman. Right? There is what these older traditions are saying, there is something particular about sovereignty. To be a king isn't really, or queen, isn't about political power. There is a numinous quality. that exists in that place of mediation. It's in the Tree of Life, the angel of Tiferet is Mikael, who is the priestly angel, but also kind of a kingly kind of figure. And it's the sort of very ancient image of the priest king. Yes, I think it is. No, it is. I mean, actually, absolutely, I think that. This is a woman who is very dedicated. Right? I mean, you know, there's something with and I think one of the interesting things about Britain is that, however mayhem our political system, we've got this clone of a prime minister. But there's something about this ancient kind of idea of sovereignty. That so I don't know how Charles will hold it when he goes, but actually you can really see that the Queen holds to that, there's a sense of being of service. Now we might agree or disagree with all of it, but it's absolutely clear this woman believes it absolutely fundamentally in that. And I think it was interesting, I think what happened around Prince Harry, where he didn't want to be, he didn't want to participate in that anymore, and he wanted a different kind of life. Which was fine, but he then couldn't be part of that because he wasn't aligned with that anymore. So I do think that's something she takes very, very seriously, really. And certainly, if you ever watch ever seen the coronation ceremony on TV or something, there is something extraordinary in that anointing, that this is not just a sort of a drama, not just a show. There's something very particular that gets invoked in that somewhere. Yes, they do. They do another crown. Really, I think the crown really shows that very well. Actually, that series really does show that kind of dedication and that kind of commitment to something, even if it costs you in your personal life.
But the actual ceremony in Westminster Abbey.
Oh yes, no.
Talks about when he sees Elizabeth being
created,
and what happens when you close off the section.
Yes, that's right.
Like the divinities calm down.
No, exactly. Yes, that's right. That's right. No, they do that very beautifully. Then, yeah, it's good to remember to them. Yes, if you ever watch The Crown, look at that. Look at that bit. It really shows that kind of quality somewhere.
It's interesting thing in secular society to say, how will it be with the next generation? But I think all that discussion about who would become the next king, whether it would bypass Charles and all, it's a sort of recognition of that there's got to be an inherent worthiness in the person to embody, to have the stature to do that. In a way that we don't expect of our politicians.
No, that's right, and I think it's sort of interesting what happened. What happened with Edward? In a way, I mean, it's all about personal life or whatever. But actually, what he did was to privilege his personal life over the sense of being king. And from what we learn about him later, of course, that he, was pro-Nazi, was a friend of Hitler, and some of what was about to happen in the world, which nobody, of course, at that point really knew about, it was really essential that he was not the king, because and I think there's something about this kind of quality that we're looking at, really, that because kingship can be abused enormously. That kind of, I mean, Putin is an interesting figure in relationship to this, because people keep talking about Putin as though he wants to re-establish the Soviet Empire. I don't think he does at all. What I think if we look into Putin's history, the person he most identifies with is Peter the Great, who was the great military, very successful Tsar who established the Russian Empire. And all the imagery you find Putin using is kind of in the Russian Federation using harks back to that period. And one of the really odd things, just in given that Sweden is really wanting to join NATO, is that one of the great powers in the world at the 18th century time of that part of the world was Sweden. Charles II of Sweden was one of the great military leaders of Sweden. And was defeated by Peter the Great. great battle called the Pulkata battle, where they so there's a sort of so one of the things that if you like, if we look at Putin and we look at his, if you like, czar in all but name, really, you see that kind of corrupt aspect of kingship really kind of harking back, not in the service of his people, but in the service of his own, the idol, his own image of himself as a contemporary Peter the Great, trying to re-establish the empire of Peter the Great so that he will be this powerful kind of figure. So the you know, and in this sense of sovereignty, the danger is that power, the numinosity of sovereignty, that energy of Tiferet, that powerful energy, gets taken into and is annexed by the idol figure that sits in the center of Yesod, and which then aggrandizes the personality, and then has to, and then of course, because it is fundamentally unstable, has to keep on, you know, idols always have to be constantly fed, because that if you've done that with Tiferet, you've massively deformed the whole nature of the tree, it's not balanced, so it has to be continually propped up. Now the image really of the blasted tower that we find in this path is this image of the tower that is constantly falling down because it's not based in truth and balance and sovereignty, and so it constantly has to be propped up. Idols of our nature constantly have to be fed in order for them to continue functioning. So the particular work of that path, of this path, is the letting the idols of our nature, letting the false house fall down. Because actually what happens in the psyche is that there is a continual work of propping up the false house, recreating it. It's in the Merlin story, it's like we're continually rebuilding this thing that continually falls down, we continue rebuild it, and we will sacrifice anything, sacrifice innocence, sacrifice anything to keep ourselves safe in that way. And that's the power of the Geoffrey of Monmouth story, even when he experiences that whole thing with, you know, so his choice at that point, had he listened to Merlin, would be to surrender to Ambrosius and Uther and put himself at their mercy, and then he might have found a different path. But instead what he does, he finds another tower and walls himself up with his daughter and tries to do something even more perverse and awful, and ends up being just being entirely destroyed. Yes, it is. I mean, the book of Ezekiel in particular talks about what happens when the so if we look at that, it's all in this. Which chapter is this? Chapter 6. So it's the one with the linen-clad priest in it. Yeah, chapter 7, the linen clad priest, is all about that setting up of an idol in a sacred place. And you've got this, you know, you've got this sort of image really that let me just find the right thing. Yeah, in the book of Ezekiel, you get this phrase, "A son of man, these men have set up their idols in their heart and put the stumbling block of their iniquity before their face." Now, the word for stumbling block is mikshul, and its root meaning is idol. So you set up an idol in the holy place, in the heart. So that place where Tiferet combines with the false image of ourselves. And when that happens, and when people do that, and they're actually very, very powerful. Because if you like, the higher capacities of the spirit are being used in the service of the idol, in the service of this stumbling block, in order to generate. And it's why the phrase given for this form of evil in the Bible is the world called Avon, which is it's like the deepest quality of evil. It is a rejoicing in iniquity, because it's using, if you like, the gifts of the spirit to corrupt the world. And in a sense that the when the book of Ezekiel talks about the word for Hebrew is lev, and it means the central place. So you set up an idol in the central place. And it has this image of the, you know, in the Judaic temple, the Holy of Holies is an empty place. It's a place of mystery. But the book talks about the corrupted elders of Israel are corrupted, and they have set up idols in their chambers of imagery. And so they have filled the empty place, the place of mystery, the place of the pure intuition, with this image of ourselves, or the image of ourselves that we want to, that then we just want to propagate. We want this image to be immortal, this image that so that it will dominate the world forever. You know, it's the Shelley poem, "I am Ozymandias, King of Kings, look at my works, ye mighty in despair." You know, it's that intention. You know, you find it all over Egypt, the images of Ramses II, you know, which is what the Tashelli poem is about this image of Ozymandias that's at Medina Tabu, which is this fallen down, absolutely fallen down. And I hope the Egyptian government are thinking about putting that image back together again. I hope they never do, because it's sort of spoiled, you know. It's actually amazing to look at that image and think, well, this is what Shelley saw. And it's absolutely the most, I can see why they'd want to put it together again. It's just phenomenal, it's enormous. But it's actually all in pieces. And it's a really good image of the blasted tower, in that sense. The falling, the house that must be allowed to fall down.
So does this equate with the veil? This could be the veil.
Well, it is the veil, yeah. In a sense, right? So that in a sense that the house is propped up by is the continual internal dialogue, right? Which is our continual subliminal re-describing ourselves in terms of ourselves, in terms of what is known to us. Now hopefully, and I don't think anybody is as pernicious as Putin or anything like that, so it's not that we are tremendous dangers to the world, but there are parts of us that of course partake of that kind of quality and which obstruct our deeper life.
Our modern times seem to have increasingly this sort of cult of individualism.
Yeah. Well, he's interesting, isn't he? And I think that's part of, and certainly, you know, what the bloody social media thing does is to reinforce that kind of quality of life on our terms. Everybody should have life on our terms. The idea of surrender to something, the idea of service to something. And in a way, what gets played out, I suppose, between Harry and Meghan and the Queen of these, is that new world of kind of well, I've got a right to live my life, which of course he has, but you can't have that and have the other. Right, so you can, you know, I perfectly support Harry in doing what he's done, but what I don't support is him wanting also to have the privileges. You know, so the whole point of I think of that sovereignty place is that because you're in service, there are some privileges that come to you to enable you to be of service. But if you don't want to be of service, that's completely fine, but you can't have that as well. But it's so in a sense, what Harry is wanting to do there is effectively to take the Tiferet energy with him, to have the numinosity of kingship, princehood, I suppose, but to turn that into a commodity. Because I mean, that's effectively what he and Meghan are doing. They're sort of promoting themselves as royals, really, and using royalty as a selling point. And in a sense, for all of us, that point where we can sell ourselves to get approval, to be loved, to get a good job, to feel important in the world. It's all part of that kind of tendency somewhere.
It's a cynical thing that when you have perceived status in the world, I'm thinking of Fergie being a poor runner of
yeah.
And also, I suppose, there's the thing that is the most vulnerable that fall into this trap, you know, that don't have So I think you'd say Harry's probably one of the more vulnerable people in his way of life.
Yeah, I was going to say it comes from a wounded place,
doesn't it? Yeah. Oh, totally, yes, of course.
Connection, so giving perspective and balance.
Yeah.
In some ways, he is serving in a different way. It's so muddled up, but in the same way that people loved Diana, because she felt they could see someone actually wounded.
This is a really interesting thing, isn't it, for modern days, that we like to see people who we respect people for emoting their woundedness in public. Yeah. Is that a public service? I don't. It's seen as one. I don't quite understand it.
Or is it how they carry it, or how they portray that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Of course, if it's put in service, like, you know, with the Paralympians and all that sort of thing, that's a real connection you made, wasn't it? Very difficult subject.
Well, I suppose it helped, you know, it's the beginning of seeing underneath where there is problems that need to be healed. It's only the beginning, it's only saying there's problems, rather than this pretense of everything being very sweet.
I don't know how it might be to be born into the royal family with that sprinkle of magic that's held in the community in a way. A lot of people are not Republicans now, but there is a sort of magic, isn't it, that and I wonder how it must be to move out of that magic and still want it. But have you still got it, or have you not? Is it our perception of Prince Harry with the magic, or?
And was he held? Because his mother died when he was very young.
Yes.
There must be some trauma related.
Oh yes, I'm not denying all that. I was just thinking about sovereignty and magic and service and having that given to you almost on a plate in a funny sort of way.
Something about the individual cult. There's a lot of feeling in the world that the individual is important, and it's something that we have to almost cultivate and protect more. But I don't think it was as important when the Queen was.
No, I agree. It was frowned upon. I mean, the stiff upper lip was not, you know, an invention, and people deplored Edward, you know, for bringing his personal life into, you know, they saw it as completely irrelevant, you know, and that the guy just didn't get how we behaved at that time. It was, and this is a real reaction against it, but I heard someone say, someone was sort of saying, I'm not afraid of showing my emotions. You're showing parodies of emotions. I think that's the problem with social media and modern life, is that you're not getting down to real emotions. You're actually, people are acting things out for us, you know, in reality, crap like that. Mm-hmm. But it's nothing genuine. Because if it was, it would be unbearable to watch.
Mm. Yes, that's right.
You know, like seeing that poor little sob walk behind his mother's
Oh yeah, that was just awful.
Wicked.
Yeah, that was awful.
That's the stuff that we find difficult, because it's real.
So I'm just thinking, this conversation is making me think of just, I came out of, after being on retreat in South Africa for 6 months, and being on the plane and seeing seeing Bush steal the American election away from Al Gore, and watching the Big Brother, which had come on TV while I was on retreat, and it was the first of the reality shows. And there's something about the power of illusion, almost the power of. I mean, it's perfectly obvious that Gore won the election, but in retrospect, Gore won the election. But it was stolen, in Florida by Jeb Bush, by Bush's brother, who was the governor. I mean, that's what decided it. And I remember just sitting there, just baffled, and watching, you know, something that I had in American election system. It's a complicated place, but I'd never ever thought of the American election system as fundamentally corrupt, and I was being, and it was so obvious that it was corrupt. It was just, it wasn't at all subtle. And then at the same time, then I'm watching this program, which I have no, I had no standard of reference for really, which is kind of, I seem to be watching people in a house. Well, I mean, they didn't seem to be doing it. They occasionally were talking to each other, or, you know, and I kept waiting. There's a play, it's an avant-garde play, is this, you know, kind of, and eventually, of course, I realized it wasn't. But in both cases, it's like the precursor to the world that we're now kind of living in, you know, and this is the year 2000, so 20, you know, this is the sort of summer of August of 2000, so this is like, you know, 22 years, nearly 22 years ago. And of course I had no idea what was about to happen in the world in terms of this objectification of the psyche and the enactment of the events of the psyche and the enactment of emotion, as Penny's talking about, suddenly becoming, you know, and it's sort of, you know, complicated me as a psychotherapist, because at one level, one of the great problems of Britain as previously was that people wouldn't express emotion, you know, certainly any, those who've been a therapist for any length of time, you know, a lot of the problems that people were coming with was their inability to express emotion. That's not a problem now, but whether those emotions are actually connected to something deeper really is a problem, because there is, we have learned an enactment of the self, and the, you know, it's almost a sort of an, and clearly people who go on reality shows are literally doing that, but also social media massively invites that. People perform their lives for people, you know, and this whole powerful thing about likes, that, you know, the whole thing about that, the whole social media thing depends upon getting likes, people clicking on and liking and approving of you, which goes right into very early places in ourselves of need for validation, need for approval, need for love. So this subtle sort of thing kind of, you know, and then we get into things like filters where you image and get manipulated, and you produce a more pleasing looking image of yourself. Now all of that is about this territory of yesod. It's all about this, it's like the sort of yesod is erupted really out of, you know, and annexed both netzach and hod, right? So that feelings become the simulacrum of feelings, thoughts become illusory thoughts, and even physical sensations are not experienced in a sort of direct sense anymore. They're glamorized, or they're kind of excitable, or excite, because it's so the effect of this is that, and this is in a way is the false tower, it's this yesodic image that eclipses everything else, and in that sense can eclipse the deeper spheres, particularly the middle triangle of the tree, gets pulled into that. Not the deep part of the spirit, not the supernal, the kind of, well, the Kabbalistic teaching is that if you like, our deep will, our deep imagination, our deep sense of being remains always, that non-dual place remains always untouched. But even the middle triangle of the soul, which represents the capacity for compassion, capacity for clarity, the power of intuition and connection, can get dragged into the yesodic image and be used at the service of that.
With the social media and all of that.
Yeah.
Are you building a false self upon the false self?
Yeah, totally, exactly. Because it's a double. That's part of it. It's a double layer, right? Because we've all got a false self that we've just manually created from the events of our life. But then you consciously manipulate that. So it's like you create a whole another layer on it, on top of it.
Really complicated.
So it gets much more complicated. No, totally. And you know the whole image of the. I mean, the selfie is a good example of that, isn't it? That's a sort of. Because that's the idea of a selfie itself, I think, is something that, of course, is a fairly recent idea. People would take pictures of each other, But the idea that you take a picture of yourself, and then the idea of the selfie stick that enables you to do that. When we had in the Valley of the Kings recently, basically one of the things that's happened to Egypt is the cruise ships have started going up and down the Nile, have started up again, which means there are people now visiting the Valley of the Kings who wouldn't normally. They're not there, they're just there because they're on a cruise ship. And it was shocking because I haven't seen it for so many years. So all these people are piling into the tombs, not to look at the tombs, but to have pictures of themselves with the tombs as the background. And I sort of know that happens, but I haven't seen it for years. So it was absolutely shocking. You know, so you've got these extraordinary places wanting to understand. And then there's these grinning people going, oh, all the way, you know, just having a picture of myself with that as a vague kind of slightly exotic background. And again, that's, as you say, that's creating the false self on top of the self. The false self already exists. So you end up with a very dense, very, very complicated form that you have to keep on propping up. So it's a kind of, so that's why the sense of, you know, you have to keep on reinventing yourself, recreating your profile, keep on getting likes, keep on, you know, and keep on keeping on. And that's where we're back with this image of Vortigern, the king whose tower is falling down, that he will do anything to keep propped up. Oh, massively, of course, because things are, you know, bad enough when we're just with the problems of the self we've constructed from our childhood, and then when we have these this mad idealized sense of who we think we should be, the kind of, of course, you know, and that's why, you know, one of the things that COVID does, because it stopped so much of the stimulation and created a enforced stopping across the world, lots of people went crazy because they couldn't handle it without that constant kind of stimulation.
A surprising number also found it an incredible relief, didn't they? Sort of release of pressure.
But that was a minority of people, Penn. I think most people really hated COVID. And you can just see now where the world, you know, kind of travelling at the moment is phenomenal. Everybody's travelling. Mm. I mean, you know, because actually it's like, well, now we can travel again. So I think yes, a minority of people found it a relief, but mostly people didn't. And mostly people have been desperate to, you know, kind of get back to business as usual, really.
Yeah. I was just thinking with young people particularly who've been caught up in that frenetic way of always doing, actually gave them, it forced them into an alternative. That might have been a really good healthy alternative to their constant overachieving, overdoing, overstimulation all the time.
Well, it could have been, but of course there's no support for that in the culture, really.
You know. It just got really sucked even more into social media.
Yeah, no, that's probably what happened. There was nothing in the external world.
You entered this sort of false internal world.
Yeah, that became even more strengthened, yeah, totally.
And a lot more psychosis, really.
Yeah.
I mean, my team worked with early intervention in psychosis, huge, actually, especially for older people. Yeah. Normally, we would work with young people around university age, but there's been this huge, with COVID explosion in first episode psychosis in people in the middle years.
Yeah, no, totally. Yeah. Yeah, exactly, because all those props are taken away and they couldn't handle what they found there, yeah.
What is the antidote?
Two.
This sounds like you're describing an accumulation,
the antidote is what we'll be looking at all weekend, really. It's that place of where you stop and you let things fall down, and then you come back to a kind of a bedrock place. Yeah. Right, you know, you have to be able to tolerate the falling down of the tower. Right, I mean, without denial, really, you know, in a sense, you have to let, because actually it isn't that you have to do something, you just have to let it go, stop sacrificing your life energies or the world around you in order to keep your tower propped up. You have to tolerate the falling apart, in a sense.
So going back to Salmon as well, our first meditation.
Yeah.
So what I'm finding is that even in that meditation, something's still not blocking exactly, but that, you know, that this veil isn't
No, it isn't. No, and actually, but it's the part including that and your perception of that blockage, right, and the sensing of that is part of the deconstruction. Right. So if so, one of the ways that meditation can be misused is we have an ecstatic kind of time and we just think, oh, brilliant, we have come out of feeling brilliant. Right. Whereas actually, what should happen is you sense the flow in you and the block in you.
Right.
And it's by being able to embrace the block, embrace the places that are restricted, as well as the places that are flowing, that we actually, the tower, the false tower falls down, the veil starts to open.
Right. So kind of being with what is.
Simply being what is, that's exactly right. So it's because the construction of the tower is based on denial and is the creation of a fantasy that protects us from what is.
Yeah. Is it usually an external event, so it happens, that causes this? When we are ready for that to happen, if something is triggered from outside.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. And I think, you know, if we have done the inner work, we're able to meet that, whatever happens, more fully, because we're able to collaborate with it. Right? Whereas if, you know, sometimes, I mean, a psychosis is a good example, I think, right? Because actually what happens is if you like, the something is happening for somebody that they cannot handle, like their system cannot adapt to, and so their system splits and splits into psychotic fantasy. You know, so because they haven't got a ground that can integrate the new energies. And in a certain sense, I think, you know, life all the time is offering us opportunities to open if we will allow ourselves just to trust how things actually are. But part of what we're working with in this is the momentum of the psyche, right? So it's not as simple. So when we do a meditation like the fish in the well, or you know, what happens is we're chipping away each time at a form that has density because of momentum, because it's been repeated so many times. So each time we notice it, we interrupt the momentum a little. We enable the possibility of something else to emerge.
But it's interesting that life offering opportunities to, I can't quite remember how you finished that, but to trust life, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly so, that's right.
And just thinking about, you know, womb experience and the bad womb experience.
Yeah.
And that being quite, you know, obviously no way of processing that at that point in development. That sort of trusting life.
Well, totally, right. And so in that place, right, because one of the things that happens when we touch that sense of connection with life, we touch that poisoned womb experience.
Yeah.
And so we're working with this is the way is this whole idea of Merlin working with the two dragons.
Right.
So it isn't one thing, it isn't a straightforward. I mean, that's what I like about that story, is that what he comes to at the end is he comes to this two opposing energies that have to be alchemized. So that sense of the goodness of life and the poisonous nature of life in that case.
So that's what the red and white is.
Yeah, in that case, we could say in that instance, that's what the red and white is. So as you go down into the depths, really, what you come to are these patterns where there are opposites in relationship going on, really. So there's some sense of, because it's, you know, if I think of my own very early experience, I have this sense of, in the very earliest place, of the delight of entering into, in the conception experience, entering into wanting to be there, and then having a really bad sense of the womb, and so then there being a conflict set up, which I want to be here, I don't want to be here. And so when I touch my own version of that sense of the poisonous womb, but the power of wanting to enter into life, are my dragons, in a sense, that I have to kind of work with and to find a resolution to.
And it's about being with.
Well, being just with. As they are. No, as they are. Not creating a clever solution that fixes it. It's being, noticing the interplay of both these energies within me. And the more I can do that, the more space I have around that, the more capacity I have to befriend those energies and to work constructively with them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So really that sun and whale meditation, you could spend 30 minutes with a red dragon.
Yeah, totally. Oh yeah, totally. No, totally. Absolutely. Yeah, and yet you would just hang out with that. You'd hang out with that, and then that's almost the important thing, that you just trust what arises, and you hang out with that, and just be present with it, and learn about it, you befriend it. So that's sort of befriending these parts of the heart and just bringing them present somewhere. Right? Okie dokie, let's have a break for our lunch and come back at 1:30. Okie dokie.
Are they? Where does it come from?